The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
We're very honored tonight to present Bernard-Henri Lévy, who is a philosopher, journalist, activist, and filmmaker. Monsieur Henri Lévy, known to many as BHL, is part of a great European tradition of public intellectuals. In his work, he continues the tradition of Camus, Malraux, and Sartre. He is a man of passion and action. Christopher Hitchens writes of BHL, he wrote in the last week's New York Times Book Review, "If you wanted to sum up his political outlook in a phrase, you would find yourself borrowing Orwell's remark that it's not enough to be an anti-fascist, one must also be in principle anti-totalitarian." Among his dozens of books are American Vertigo, Barbarism with a Human Face, and Who Killed Daniel Pearl? His writing has appeared in a wide range of publications throughout Europe and the United States. His films include the documentaries Bosnia and A Day in the Death of Sarajevo. Monsieur Lévy is co-founder of the anti-racist group SOS Racism and has served on diplomatic missions for the French government. "I try to speak of things I have lived through personally," he writes in his book. And as he reviews the events of May 1968, his trips to South Africa and India, and his alliances and sparrings with a vast range of figures interlinked through spheres of politics, history, and philosophy, you will find just quite a fascinating conversation going on. He will discuss what he calls the new barbarisms, among them the future of anti-Americanism and anti-Semitism, how a misguided idea of tolerance will harm democracy, with one of our own great public intellectuals, Arianna Huffington. Ms. Huffington is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, What Would We Do Without It This Week, a nationally syndicated columnist and the author of 12 books, including the recent Pigs at the Trough. She's also the co-host of Left, Right, and Center on KCRW 89.9 FM, Public Radio's public political roundtable program. We will have both of our authors' books for sale tonight, courtesy of our library store. They'll both be signing during the reception, so please join us afterwards. Join us to learn more about Fora TV. And now please welcome Arianna Huffington and Bernard-Henri Lévy.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for being here, for succeeding in getting here from the West Side especially. Since you have to contend with not one, but two people with accents, it's particularly important that this works. So please tell us if you can't hear me, and then if you can't hear Bernard-Henri, or BHL, as everybody calls him. So can you hear us okay? So it's for me an incredible pleasure to be here in this conversation because we have sort of crossed paths, mostly in television studios, but have never really sat down for a proper conversation like now. So it's really a great pleasure. I'm glad you're here, but frankly, even if you weren't, I would be really looking forward to this conversation, especially because the issues that you're addressing here in this book, Left in Dark Times, are issues that, from my own perspective, I've been grappling with. So I'd like to start by asking you about the very idea of the left, and maybe you can explain to us, because, of course, it has its origin in France and even in the way that they were sitting. And so what is interesting for me is that I'm trying here to just challenge the whole idea of left and right as being obsolete, because there is a new center in American politics. And I know you're approaching it from the left, but you're so familiar with America and having written American Vertigo and spending a lot of time here. You also know that some of what you're describing about the French left and the European left applies to the American left. So my larger question is, are these categories of left-right really still legitimate, or are we simply in a sort of way that no longer has much relevance, addressing other and new problems.
Thank you, Ariana. First of all, you will very soon discover that my accent is even worse. And from far, from far. Number two, I have to tell you how pleased I am to be back in LA and how I am honored to be on this stage with Ariana Huffington. What she did since a few years with her online magazine, online newspaper, is such a rare, exceptional thing which tries to be imitated all over the world. But there is only one Ariana. That's the problem that they have when they want to imitate. And for me, it's a real treat to be here with her. I saw her 2 days ago at Larry King's show. There were four people discussing the elections, but to be frank, there was only one. She was her. She was great. So great pleasure to be with you back here with Ariana. About your first question, it is one of the questions which gave the point of departure to this book. And it's a question which was raised for me and asked to me, and not asked, the reply, the answer was asserted by a friend of mine who was about to become president of French Republic, who calls me an afternoon of January 2007. I pick up the phone, and he tells me more or less what we are talking about. He tells me, come on, we are friends since 23 years, I'm running for office, you are my friend, left and right does not mean anything any longer, come and endorse me. You must know by parenthesis that France is a maybe strange country, where a man running for office can pick up the phone to call a writer to ask an endorsement. This would not happen in America. I don't imagine Mrs. Palin or Mr. McCain calling any writer of any sort. She calls God. She calls the memory of the dinosaurs. But a writer, she would not. But France, we have many things going wrong in our country. This thing is rather sympathetic. Running for president, calling simple writer to ask for endorsement. So his argument is that right and left does not signify, does not mean any longer anything. Come with me, we'll make the revolution. The conversation is the very big, I relate the verbatim, the words of the conversation in the first 15 pages of the book. It's rather a funny piece, as you will see, a sort of comedy. Sarkozy is a great character, very open-minded. He has a peculiarity, which is that he has no real interiority, no real intimacy. Any idea which crosses his mind goes out through the mouth. It's like this. No, it is not. The general counsel may be here, I don't care. It is just a fact. You know what I mean? It's a fact, and it's great. Means transparency, frank, no opacity, and so on. So my belief, and that's why, number one, I did not endorse him. That's why, number two, I wrote this book to explain, to reply to Nicolas Sarkozy and Ariana Huffington, to explain why, from my point of view, this sort of dividing line still work today. And you have an example. Nowadays, these very hours in America, with the current crisis, this book, I live part of my life now, part of the year in America, this book is not about France. It's about France and it's about America. When I say the liberals, I mean them in France and in America. And I did not predict, and I did not. I would not dare to say that this terrible situation is an illustration of whatever was written. But what happens this day is a proof that the dividing line between right and left still works. You are in the situation where you are, not because of a will of the sky, because of a precise politics of deregulation, of tax cuts, of misconception of the state, and so on, which is more or less one of the definitions in America, like in France, of the right. In front of this crisis, you have many replies, and you have some rightist and you have a leftist reply. Barack Obama, when he said immediately, from the first day, that, okay, well, the Congress might have to save Wall Street, but what about Main Street? What about the homeless, more and more numerous, at a few yards, a few meters from Beverly Hills, who are losing their house and so on? He had a liberal reflex. So, of course, the line is still there. The difference is stronger than ever. And you will experiment it, I think, in this country in the next days, because the $700 billion will not be the end of the story. You will have an ideological battle on this topic, how, who, what next, etc., etc. So, yes, I do believe that this distinction still works.
But in fact, if you look at the way McCain has been sounding, he's been sounding even more left than Obama. That's what is so confusing at the moment, that he's been arguing that you can't just save Wall Street, that this is about protections for the American worker, you know, who he said is the greatest fundamental of the American economy. And Barack Obama said last night in a speech that didn't get a lot of attention that the bankruptcy reform should not be in the bailout bill, even though the bankruptcy reform would be incredibly important for people whose homes are being foreclosed and they could get some leniency, the way Wall Street is getting leniency. So that is really what I'm talking about. You know, this that there are ideological divisions, but they're not playing out in modern politics here. And in fact, you would have thought this is a great moment to take on the right and its anti-regulation, anti-government policies, but the lines are being blurred. And McCain claims he's been for regulation and he wasn't listened. So my point is that are these distinctions still useful? And are they missing the point that there is a new center in American politics? If you look at the majorities of American people who want something done about healthcare, which was supposed to be a left-wing position, something done about global warming, supposed to be a left-wing position, something done about bringing the troops home, and something done about corporate responsibility, like four main areas, I would say we have 60 to 70 to 80% of Americans who want all that. Are they still... Has the left massively expanded in America?
Maybe yes. On this point, you ask it as a joke, but maybe yes. If you compare, as I do myself in this book, America 40 years ago, my first travel in America was 45 years ago. And the America of today, you must admit that America achieved in half a century the biggest revolution, well-achieved revolution, ever seen anywhere. When you go to the south of America, in Alabama, in Tennessee, these states which were the domain, which were the field of segregation, admitted racism, remnants of Ku Klux Klan, and so on. And if you see what it became, a huge development took place, a sort of revolution, and you can say that in spite of the 8 years of Bush administration, in spite of the apparent glory of Mrs. Palin, the real trend, the deep trend, the deep undercurrent in this country, contrary to the cliché, which is produced in Europe, especially by professional anti-Americanists, is a leftist trend. I do believe. I do believe that if a president tomorrow had the idea to put into question the right to abortion, had the temptation to move back on civil rights, he will find the majority of the people of America in front of him. Something really happened. I don't know if it is 60%, 70%, but yes, I would not deny that the real movement is this one. And it's important to say, because the cliché in France is exactly the contrary. The cliché consists in saying in France, in Europe, all over the world, in Muslim countries, that America has become mad, that America is more and more the country of the stupid rednecks, conservatories, and so on. I don't think so. I think that the Bush administration was, as a sort of a rear guard last battle, a sort of last movement, last protest of the old beast who does not want to die and who takes a last movement before disappearing from the scene. But the reality, yes, I think, is much more toward the center and much more to the left. And I tell you, I am maybe one of the oldest in this audience. I remember 45 years ago, south of America, it was unbelievably different as it is today. So this is one thing. The other thing is McCain pretends, him also, that we should save Main Street and not only Wall Street, blah, 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 blah. Okay, there is politics. And there is also the patience of the people, the lies, the demagogy. This belongs to politics also. McCain will not say the contrary. He sees that there is such an anger inside the people of America in front of the very idea of taxpayers paying for the miscalculations, for the moral faults of a handful of speculators. He cannot say the contrary. But what we have to see in these sort of circumstances is not what is said in the heat of the debate, is the track records of everyone. If you look at the track record of, I'm not American, and I don't believe that Obama is an angel fallen from the sky. But you just compare on this question of regulation, on this question of healthcare, on the question of knowing if the task of a government is or not to help the have-nots, to give a shelter to the homeless, to give a decent way of being ill and of not dying in some areas. If you look at the track records, I'm sorry, but you see a McCain who never gave a damn about that. Never cared. It was never his problem. He, 90% of the time, voted in favor of deregulation. Track records are published everywhere. And you have an Obama who, since the beginning of his career, has been on the other side. Left and right means also different things, not only regulations. When the question of education is concerned, you have today in America, we have not that in Europe, but we have in America, a real debate, seems crazy to me, but it exists, about the question of the creationism. You have, Sarah Palin really believes that the dinosaurs were there contemporary of Moses. She really believes that Moses and the prophets of the Bible were surrounded by dinosaurs. She really believes that in the Death Valley or in the Grand Canyon, Noah and his ark went down in the big flood with animals on the swift boat, the swift veteran swift boat of Noah in the Grand Valley. She really believes that. So between somebody who really believes that and a rational, enlightened, moderate, and modern political man, you have a real, how does Huntington says, clash of civilization. You have a clash of civilization between Palin and Obama. That's a fact. That's politics. That's the one other real dividing line on the question of creationism, on the question of abortion, of the liberty, the freedom of women, freedom to decide to give birth or not, in good conditions or not. You have a real partition of the world, two really different visions of mankind. So it exists more and more, in spite of what the actors can say in order to save themselves. McCain today seems to me, I have nothing against him, he has a great past, he was a hero and so on, but he seems in such a disarray, such a distress, losing hand, that he does anything to delay the debate, to go back to Washington, to involve in what it is not his business, to say that he's more leftist than Obama. Okay, this is just words, 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 like in Shakespeare, but a bad Shakespeare play, by the way. Now, what I would add, last word, is that, and this is the real thesis of this new book, right and left still exist, but it is not the end of the world. It is not the only way for men and women to divide themselves and to lead the debate on the real burning issues of their time. It is not the last word. Right and left do exist, but it is not the last word of the ideological debate in America or in Europe.
And that's why you say in the book that we need to rebuild the left. So there are clearly a lot of criticisms you've had throughout your career with the left and many disagreements, especially about the totalitarian temptation of the left, you know, first towards communism, now the sort of complacency about the dangers of Islam in its terrorist forms. So there are these kind of family disagreements. Are they sort of disagreements with a group that, as you have also told in your conversation with Sarkozy, which is fascinating, you all have to read it, that out of a family loyalty you could not endorse him. So you have these very sort of conflicting responses to the left. How do you reconcile them? And what do you mean by rebuilding the left specifically? How would you rebuild it?
In my life, I have no real occupation. I am not a dentist. I am not a businessman. I'm not a journalist. I'm not a carpenter. I am a man who, leftist, who since his first youth has as a main occupation to bother, to pick, to disturb the left. That's my occupation. It turns, when I look at the past 40 years, it happens to be that. My occupation is that, from the left, to tell the left what seems to me the truth and the truth which she denies. My occupation is to denounce, to point out, to stress upon the mistake, the moral faults, sometimes the crimes of which the left is either guilty or accomplice. This is how it turns. 30 years ago, I made a book, it was told to you in the presentation, which created a big turmoil on the left, Barbarism is a Human Face. It made a scandal, a terrible. I was nearly stoned alive by the left of my country and even in America. I remember some talks in some academic circles, in some universities. Time magazine made his cover story about me and the movement I launched. And I remember the left more than angry, wanting to get rid of me, because I said that the whole system was built on a huge lie, and not only a lie, but a very mortal, lethal, and criminal lie, which was the historicism, the historical optimism, the leftist providentialism, the idea that a sort of natural movement led the real society to a perfect world which was promised to us, whatever we did, and so on. Today, 30 years passed, I believe that thanks to, not to the intellectuals, but thanks to Solzhenitsyn, John Paul II and America, it was a joint venture between the three. The Catholic Church, a great writer, and a superpower, joint venture between the three, and fourth, the peoples of the real countries, of Poland, of Czechoslovakia, and so on, the peoples, plus the Pentagon, plus the Vatican, plus Solzhenitsyn, at equal, they destroyed communism. So this story is finished. It's out, and except a few crazy guys, little circles, little sects of continuous believers, nothing serious happens in this field. But I believe that there is a new disease, some new venins, some new poisons, which took the place, which replaced the old poisons of the so-called Marxism-Leninism, which I try to identify in this book, and which I try to combat, which I try to fight. So, from the left, against the left. And you said, you quoted, and you are right, my sentence to Sarkozy, faithful to my family. It is true. I tell that to him. But a few pages after, I happened to think, faithful to my family, well, and what if the family is wrong? What if the family takes the bad path? And my conclusion, my real feeling since my youth, is that an intellectual, somebody who has the chance to write books, as we do, Ariana and me, to direct some newspapers or to contribute. People who have a real free speech, who can speak on their own, who are not obliged to enlist in a simple way. Our duty is twofold. We have a duty of faithfulness to the family and a duty of unfaithfulness to the family. The combination of the two, duty of faithfulness, duty of unfaithfulness, is the real way of serving the truth. And there is a great poet, an Italian poet, Pier Paolo Pasolini, who was killed, stoned, really him, on a beach near Roma 20 years ago by some hooligans. He told about the duty of abjuration. Le devoir d'abjuration, abjuration, denying, being unfaithful to not only one's family, but also your own thought. The real duty of an intellectual is to be unfaithful. In order to think more, you have to be unfaithful to what you thought before. The real work, the real process of the thought is the constant abjuration of provisional truth, which happens to be a blockage, which happens to be a little stone. You have stones which are put in the reins, you know, in the reins, which make you very sick. You have stones also in the brain, and you have stones also in the body of work. And these stones have to be broken. This is the duty of an unfaithfulness. So family, yeah, that's what I said to Sarkozy, because he takes me on short like this. I was surprised by the call, surprised by the tone also. He told me, I don't know if they are translated in English, incredible, in the French version, they are incredible sentences. When I tell him the left is my family, he screams, what do you say, your family, what do you mean? They hate you. I said, no, not so much. Of course, they will never forgive you what they did at the time of the Gulag and so on. Nicolas, you exaggerate a little. No, you want to know? And he has, can I say the sentence?
Yes.
The left You know what you want to know what she does? I said yes. En français, elle te pisse à l'arrêt. She has a piss in your ass. I don't know if it makes sense in English. That's France. That's President Sarkozy. So, duty of faithfulness, duty of unfaithfulness.
You know, actually, that could be a great motto for all journalism, even though you claim you're not a journalist, and because ultimately what you are saying is that the greatest duty is to the truth. And that is something which has been a big problem with modern American journalism, because there's been a tendency to claim and act as if the duty of journalism is to present all sides to the story, as opposed to search for the truth. And so we've had endless debates here about global warming, as though those who thought global warming was a fraud were equally valid as those who argued about the dangers of global warming, and endless other debates like that that should never have happened. So in that sense, and one other thing about your conversation with Sarkozy, which was the sense of access, you know, the American journalists normally will sell their soul for access. So, you know, far from saying no to a potentially future president who asked for their endorsement, they would actually, as has happened again and again, shield the truth because they don't want to lose access. And we've seen that with major journalists. We saw it with Bob Woodward in the lead-up to the war, who had unlimited access practically to the White House and wrote two books that completely missed the story. You know, we saw it with Judy Miller, who basically used her access to be a mouthpiece for the administration, and on and on and on. So just a general question about journalism. France and here, I don't know whether the issues there are much different, but how do you see journalism changing?
I was fortunate enough, I was lucky enough 40 years ago. I'm not a journalist, that's true, but I like journalism. I am a philosopher, a writer, and so on, but I believe, as Albert Camus believed, as Jean-Paul Sartre believed, as Ernest Hemingway believed in America, as Truman Capote believed, that journalism is a great thing, and maybe a great achievement of literature. And that a writer or a philosopher not only should despise journalism, but should consider it as one of the best achievements. So I like journalism, even if I am not good enough, maybe, even if I am bypassed by some real journalists who have this as a real métier, occupation, but I like it. But my luck, was to begin journalism 40 years ago, in a press, which was in France, an extreme leftist press, the little newspapers which were mushrooming in the civil society around the so-called Maoist groups, extreme leftist Maoist groups, which have nothing to do with Mao, by the way. We did not care about what happened in China. It was something else. But no, it's a big story, but it was not China. But it was a real movement, deeply anti-communist, deeply, this is what I tell also in the book, deeply anti-communist, deeply convinced that communism was a force not for freedom but for slavery, and so on. And we had some newspaper, La Cause du Peuple, J'accuse, L'Idiot International, a lot of mushrooming papers. And the great thing of these newspapers is that they did not give a shit about the story of access. They did not care about access. Or to say it in another way, they thought that the real access was not White House, Palais de l'Élysée, Minister of Internal Affairs, but was, as we said in the stupid language of this time, the vivid, vibrant world of the masses, of the crowds. You know, it was not true, of course, but there was something which was not so bad. In front, compared to those institutional journalists who believed that the only access was the official news, the agenda of the president embedding you in his official plane, Air Force, little Air Force One. We have also in France a little Air Force One president. But that the real access was in the people, in the average people, this, at the end of the day, was maybe was not a great idea, but was a great school. And it vaccinated me forever, till now, against the idea that the question of the access is the question of the top access. When I make some stories, I made a few years ago, I think, real journalism, in Africa especially, but not only, about what I called the forgotten wars of our time. The forgotten wars, wars which nobody cares about. For precise reasons, by the way, which I detail and express in this book. They are not forgotten just by omission. They are forgetting is a structured one. So these forgotten wars, which I studied carefully, I never searched access to the big powers of the country or so on. The access was the poorest among the poorest. The access was a face nearly devoided, nearly emptied of humanity, because in the process of dying, the access were the nameless and outnumbered, the numberless and nameless graves or mass graves, which I happened to find in South Sudan or in Burundi, and which I tried to account. So for me, I know that there is this illness of access in the world of journalism. I'm sure that you have in America, Judy Miller, she's a great woman, but this was a mistake. She's a great journalist, but the mistake was that, and you know what it costed her, unfortunately, because she's a great writer. But illness of desire of access. The access is not there. And those who, like me, took their schools in this part of the press, we believe that the access was in coal miners. We believe that the access were in hardly French-speaking immigrant workers. We did not even believe that the access was the real working class, because we knew at this time of the Maoist period, we knew that even the working class was too organized, was already part of the big system of power. What was the access for us was the fired workers, were the unemployed workers, the marginals of the system. So you have to... I can, if you want, if you have some journalists who want some lessons of unaccess, I'm available, I come. I give a little private lecture to some of your bloggers them what the illness of access can be.
Well, in fact, in a way, blogging is a sort of reaction to the journalism of access, because the vast majority of bloggers have no access. And, you know, they're notoriously described as writing in their pyjamas in their basements. Their tradition is much more what you're describing. The difference with you is that you combine having access just by nature of your life and what you're doing, but not being the prisoner of access. In fact, you've described yourself as a journalist. These are my notes, but I don't think I'm going to go through them. as a journalist, activist, and filmmaker. So, and philosopher. Journalist, philosopher, activist, and filmmaker. So if you had to pick only one, what would you pick?
Could not choose. I could not choose because, for me, it is like different inks with which I continue the same sentence which I began 40 years ago and which I will finish, I hope, not too soon. One sentence with many inks. When I made movies, for example, I made two movies. I made a fiction movie and a documentary movie. The documentary movie was a movie on war. It was a movie which I shot in the trenches of Sarajevo, besieged by the fascist Serbians, on my way of thinking. It was a continuation of what I wrote about barbarism in general. It was a continuation not with a stilo, but with a camera. The idea of the movie came a day when I spoke with the president of Bosnia. I proposed him to write. He said, to write. You can write whatever you want. It will not change anything. I said to him, okay, so why don't we constitute, why don't we build an international brigade as our elders, like my father did in Spain? He said, please forget that. I have very good soldiers in my army. We don't need, I'm not sure you are such a great one, soldier. No, he told me, maybe there is another idea. Which one? Do you know how to film? I had no idea of how to film. I never did that. But I said, yes, of course. He told me, okay, can you find very quickly $1.5 or $2 million? I said, of course. He said, okay, so come. I give you access, but not access to me, president of Bosnia, but access to the young boys defending their city, holding the front lines in front of the Serbian army. I give you access to that where no journalists go. Come with your crew, come with your camera, film, and be a witness. For me, that was the continuation of my philosophical work. It was a way to continue barbarism with a human face and a way to prepare left in dark times. It is the same. So to choose would be, frankly, it is the same, how would I say that in other words? It is as if, in the ancient times, when in France and in America, when somebody, before the cars, before the trains, 18th century, 19th, when somebody made a coast-to-coast journey on a horse, he had to change horse at every relay. In France, at least, it was like this. Every 500 kilometers, the horse was exhausted. You had to change horse. For me, to pass from film to literature to journalism to philosophy to theater to documentary, blah, 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 it is like changing horse. It's the same ride with different horses. I'm sorry for philosophy, literature, cinema, and documentary meeting. For me, they are just horses.
and during this ride, religion, your view of religion, both personally and politically, has been very interesting to me to just read through your different descriptions of it. You are not anti-religious in the way that so many on the left are, this kind of deep sort of secularism. But you talked about the anti-wager, and taking a betting on the non-existence of God as being the way to go. You're disturbed in a way by the mega churches that you described as sort of rock and roll phenomena. So tell me a little more. First of all, how is it for you personally? Do you think it all ends with death? On the personal level, and then politically, do you feel that on balance, the fact that America is much more soaked in religion than, say, France is a good thing or a bad thing?
On a personal level, it is not very important, but I'm not religious. It's something which surprised many Americans when I was in Wisconsin, in Idaho, in South Dakota. There was always a moment where people, a waitress in a Starbucks or whatever with whom I engaged the conversation, asked me, what's your religion? And when I said, I'm atheist, I saw a sort of depression painted on the face. I understood that in this country, to be irreligious seems rather odd. And I remember especially one day, it was in a mega church. There was one of these sort of priests who hold the stage like a rocker, and who does as if God was his neighbor, riding the same car with him and his wife nearly in the bed, and so on. This is a new conception of some of the mega churches today, a very familiar God day to day, a God behind the curtain, a God speaking all the time, a God who speaking loud and deafening God. And after the speech, after he explained all that, people came to give him the book to be signed. And I did it too. I wanted a signature of the priest. And he asked me, "What is your religion?" I said, "I'm sorry, I'm atheist." And two expressions passed on his face. Number one, great astonishment. Number two, fear, as if I was a terrorist. It was the first stage of a terrorist attack. Number one, I don't believe. Number two, I don't know. A real fear, like this. And number three, he had this great quote. I don't remember it now. It is in my book, but something like, "It's okay. We have also a prayer for the atheists." With a sort of despise. I was the last of the last. I was a lost soul for him. That was funny. But I am an atheist. First, number two, I do believe that, and this for me is an act of creed, a piece of creed. I do believe, number one, I'm atheist. Number two, I respect religion. Not this one, not the religion of the guy who tells you that God speaks to him when he cuts his grass in his garden, but the real God, the God of the Christianity, of the Judaism, of the Islam, the remote God giving sense to the world, sense to ethics and so on. I don't believe in him, but I respect, I admire, and have the nostalgia of that. I expressed that in some of my previous books. But what I say in this book is that one of the worst curses on a society, a thing which we have to condemn, believers or non-believers, same, is the confusion between the two reigns, the reigns of God and the reigns of man, the sovereignty of God, the sovereignty of man. What we have to fight is the idea that the civil law should be proposed, imposed by a sacred world. Because the problem with a sacred world is that it cannot be changed, it cannot be discussed, it cannot be proved to be unfair for me, for you, for others. It is untouchable. And the problem with civil societies, the definition of democracy, which is, as Churchill said, the worst regime at the exception of all others, the definition of democracy is that the values, the truth, are unachievable, unterminable, always on process. A democrat is somebody who deeply believes that he has only provisional truth, which is the contrary of a sacred truth. So this have to be fought, this confusion between the two. And it is true, more than ever, more than somewhere else, because in America, it works. The famous wall of separation of Jefferson, whatever can be done about God being present, and so, not so true. God does not make law in America. God does not make law. You live in America under a real democracy, which laws, whose laws change according to the administrations and so on. You are not, thanks God, a religious. You are not a theocratic country. Europe either. But the question of theocracy raises in Islam. And in Islam, you have a real debate on this question. And the real point is not to discuss Islam. The interpretation of Islam, of the Quranic text, belongs to the believers, to the worshippers. It is their business. We should not, we Jews, Christians, whatever, should not involve in that. But the idea that Quran should be the basement, should provide the pillars of the organization of society, this, we have the right to say yes or no. We have the right to say that a society where the pillars of the law are given by a supposed God is an unbreathable society. And we have the duty to say that a society where the law is supposed, the law, the civil law, is supposed to be the work of the very man, which has to be transformed, which has to be ameliorated, and so on, is a society where you breathe, where you can be a little more happy, and so on. This we have to say to our Muslim friends. The real debate on Islam is this one. Not interpretation of the text, their business. But the belief that the text should be implemented in civil laws, which is theocracy, which happens in Iran, which would happen in Lebanon if the Hezbollah took power, which happens in Gaza with the Hamas, which might happen in little circles even, which could happen in Pakistan, if the jihadist groups which I met when I made my investigation about Daniel Pearl, not in the tribal areas, but in Karachi and Islamabad itself, won victory. These we have to discuss, and we have to, not to defeat them, but we have to help and to support the Democrats and the moderates and the enlightened Muslims who want to defeat these guys.
So, and absolutely, I don't think anybody would disagree, but when we go back to the place of religion in our lives and in not political life in the way you're describing it, in theocracies, but in the life of a country. And one of your heroes, Solzhenitsyn, who was, of course, a deeply religious man in the sense of spirituality rather than the imposition of one's beliefs on a country or a civil society, said in one of my favorite sayings, that if you wanted to change the world, who would you begin with, yourself or others? And for him, the sort of process of personal transformation always had a sort of a spiritual undercurrent. So can you imagine sort of a real personal transformation on that ride where you change horses and in the American way you get better and better? Can you imagine that happening without some underpinning of a spiritual belief?
I can imagine, yes. Problem with Solzhenitsyn is the problem with, at the end of the day, so many great writers and so many great thinkers. They are often less intelligent, less admirable and less great than their own piece of work. You have sometimes the contrary. You have some writers who are more intelligent than their books. Generally, they are very seductive in the salon, in the socialite life, but you don't read them after their death. The good combination is to be less intelligent than your books. It's what I hope for us. That our books are better, of course. And Solzhenitsyn, it was his case. Solzhenitsyn wrote a few books which really are more intelligent, not only of than him, but than any human beings. He wrote Archipelago of Gulag, who is more than a book, who is a miracle. Archipelago of Gulag was great for one reason, to be frank. The reason is that in front of such a disaster, such a bloodbath as the Holocaust on the side of the Nazis or the Gulag on the side of the communists, what we lack, what human gender lack, is imagination. In 1942, 43, 44, contrary to what is often said still today, everybody who wanted to know knew what was happening in Dachau, Treblinka, and Auschwitz. There were articles in the press of Germany, in the press in France, collaborationist, resistant press. We knew, I wasn't there, but they knew. Soviet Union, the Gulag, we knew. Everybody knew. The informations were there. The figures were there. We knew how many millions of innocent people, peasants, supposed counter-revolutionaries were killed by this mad mafioso, this mad little hooligan becoming a president who was Stalin. Everybody knew. But what was lacking was this faculty of the mind, which Jean-Paul Sartre described so well in his first book when he was a young boy, imagination. Between knowledge and imagination, there is not a gap, there is an abyss. You can know, if you don't imagine, it is as if you did know anything. The strength of Solzhenitsyn, the gift he made to humanity, the gift he made to all of us, was to produce one book in three, big book, one must admit, but one book, Archipelago of Gulag, who helped us to imagine what we know, gave some images of what was already known. And this is a proper of an artist, like Picasso when he made Guernica, like Musil in The Man Without Qualities about the First World War. You have many examples. A great writer has this genial capacity to make us go from knowledge to imagination. Then, when he has done that, he can not die, of course not, but he can go to sleep. He can say banal things. He can become a reactionary. He can even support Putin at the end of his life. It's not a problem. I hate Putin. I think he's one of the most... I don't hate anybody, but I think that he is a real problem today for the peace of the world and so on. And Solzhenitsyn, as you know, at the end of his life, received Putin. But it's not the problem. When you wrote Archipelago of Gulag, when you made this gift to humanity, you can do whatever you want. No problem. No problem. Now to reply to your precise question, begin by oneself or begin by the others in order to improve the world. My tendency, but this is a great point because there is really a metaphysical difference between the two replies. You have some people who believe that in order to improve the world, they have to change themselves, they have to make their own conversion. It is the Plateau theory. It is the theory of a lot of great Jewish thinkers who believe in the return, as they say, teshuvah, the return, to convert oneself, to have a sort of twist of one's soul in order to improve the world. And you have others, and I'm closer to that, who believe that the real task, the real emergency, the real beginning is to take care of the otherness. For me, the first, and this is another tradition, beginning with Aristotle and not Plato, in the Jewish thought, Levinas, more than Maharal de Prague, for example, philosophers who believe that the beginning of the thought is otherness, that the most difficult, radical, and urgent philosophical question is the question of the otherness. I'm rather in this case. Sartre believed that. Sartre believed that he was like Sarkozy is a case school, is an application of the theory of Sartre. Sartre believed that a mind, a soul, is a courant d'air, is a wind, wind in all sense, not a closed, cozy place where you have some secrets, intimacy, and so on. No, Sartre believed that the mind was a place without doors, without windows, open to everything, ideas entering, going out, and so on, and that the real secret of humanity was the otherness. I am on this side.
So it's hard to believe, but I've been giving, I've been getting little notices that I have to go to the audience. So I have an enormous amount of unasked questions, I feel that we need to go to the audience. But let me just very quickly ask one question that your good friend Charlie Rose, with whom I just talked before I came here, who also interviewed you just a couple of nights ago. And so I said to him, so what should I ask him? And he told me one thing, which is too late to ask you, so I won't ask you. But he told me a second thing, which was a nice way to sort of end my part of the questioning, a little lighter, which is to ask you about style. Because as well as being a philosopher and an activist and a journalist and a filmmaker, you're a stylist. So tell us about style.
Stylist or stylish?
Both.
Stylist, frankly, no. Frankly, no. Stylish, I don't know. My problem, and this should be, I should be guilty for that. I should be not credited, but I should be debited for that. Style means a way of being.
Well, yeah, style is much more than what you wear. It's just a way of being.
I'm always the same. Dressed the same. No, I'm so boring in my style.
But
so
style, Sarah Palin has style, right?
So, I had a good reply. Oof! Good take.
So,
My God, if I had said, this was your last question, if I have said, yes, I am stylish, style is very important for me, I would have been in the same package of Mrs. Palin.
I mean, like...
Sort of Mr. Palin.
No,
was not.
We call him First Dude. I mean, you know, she has her own individual way of presenting herself. She's not cookie cutter. She has her beehive and her glasses. She has her own way of being. I mean, whether it's wearing the same open shirt and never wearing a tie, as is your case, even when you went to the Vatican and the...
That is true.
Right? That's part of your way of being in the world. That's your personal style.
This is the point. That is true. And this, I never thought about it, but it might be boring, but something of which I can be proud of. I think that if I see the President of the Republic, I will never see Sarkozy again, but I saw former presidents before him. If I see the Pope, if I see an old comrade of my Maoist period who happens to rule a sex shop in a bad area in Paris, if I make a report, a reportage for the Huntington Post about Georgia, if I go to a black hole of the planet in a training camp of black tigers in Sri Lanka, what is true is that I am the same. I am the same. I have no double language. I have not the feeling to address these or those as if they were another humanity, or stupid, or dumb, or deaf, or I don't know what. I am the same, and I sort of address the same way. And for example, this comes to my mind now. It comes to my mind because I had to. There is a magazine who publishes some photos of me soon, and there are photos of me like lecturing, and photos of me in Darfur, and photos of me in Sarajevo. And I thought, that is strange. I'm already dressed exactly the same. I can be with the young defenders of Sarajevo, with a young terrorist of Black Tigers in Sri Lanka, or I can be lecturing with the glamorous Arianna Huffington, glamour and cool and smart. I am the same. So this might be style. To be the same in all circumstances. And style means what in this case? It means, and it makes sense It makes sense because it matches with what I believe in the depth of my heart, with what is one of my biggest belief, including in this book, when I fight against the relativism of the new left, when I fight against the culturalism of the new left, when I fight against the multiculturalism of some of the liberals. I oppose to all of them the apparently simple, in reality difficult idea of the unity of the human gender. I really believe in a single humanity. It does not mean that brotherhood is immediate, that we are all brothers holding hands in a chain. No. But I believe that the first bet you have to make when you deal with ideas, politics, or journalism is that in Rwanda, in former Yugoslavia, in Sri Lanka, and in the smartest America, we have to deal with the same humanity. And if you have to deal with the same humanity, you may be absolutely the same and be stylish in the same way.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.